Baby. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As schools across the country prepare to shut down for the summer, we decided to take a closer look at a school district where the last traditional public schools are closing forever. In Louisiana's state-run Recovery School District, the last five remaining traditional public schools will stop operating at the end of this year. And when that happens, the district will become the first all-charter system in the country. Policymakers are watching this closely. While charter school supporters point to better test scores and higher graduation rates, others say this move is fraught with the potential to leave the most vulnerable students behind. So we wanted to hear more about what this means for New Orleans and how it might influence debates about education around the country. So we've called on Jessica Williams. She's an education reporter for The Lens. That's a nonprofit news organization in New Orleans. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us for additional perspective is Edward Cremata. He's senior research analyst at the Center for Research on Education Outcomes, or CREDO. That's at Stanford University, and the center has done extensive research on charter schools around the country. Mr. Cremata, welcome to you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's nice to be here.
So, Jessica, take us back for a minute. The big push to charter schools began after Hurricane Katrina, as I understand it. Was it the plan always to move to an all-charter system after that, or did that kind of happen organically?
I would say that it was, in the initial outset, it was the plan to move this beyond a state-run initiative and have outside organizations come in and really do what they knew how to do best, the folks closest to the school to really come in and be able to turn around those schools and really bring them to a place academically where they should be. So you had a state superintendent at the time who said that he did not want to be running schools long-term. Every superintendent that's come in since then has said, we are not in the business of doing this forever. We want to pan this over to the people that know how to do it. So I will say that that was the initial goal.
What was the logic of that? Was it the sense that the schools were just so broken that this was an opportunity to, you know, not to be melodramatic about it, kind of blow it up and start all over?
I will say that there were some proponents of the system who do feel that way. I mean, you had a local school system mired in corruption, just abysmal academic performance. You know, we had a school board president that went to jail for taking bribes. You know, we had a high school valedictorian that couldn't even pass the state exit exam for graduation. You know, these were all the reasons why you had folks saying we need new faces, fresh blood, so to speak, to come in and really revamp public education in this city as we know it. Because those who were there, they failed. They had decades to get it right and they didn't do it.
After the crisis of Katrina, a lot of students left the system, and people know that story, I think, you know, pretty well. A lot of students and families migrated out of the area. But there are just under 45,000 students in the Recovery School District now. So could you just briefly tell us, like, what are the options available to them? What kinds of charter options are there? How does it work?
So what you do when you're a new parent and you're looking for a school for your child, you have two options. You can go to the Recovery School District and you can apply under the Common Application Process, which manages most of the schools in the city. Or if you want to get into some of the local parish school board schools, you can apply individually. And those processes are more labor intensive. You have to go to the school. Sometimes there are different rules. Sometimes the application date may start at a different time than everyone else's starts. So you have to be sort of savvy if you want to navigate it and get your kid into some of those schools. And those schools are typically the ones that are the highest performing, the ones that are not in the Recovery School District.
Hmm. So, Mr. Cremata, let's start with you. How does this framework in New Orleans, how does that compare to the charter school systems kind of around the country? Is this fairly typical, that the process that Jessica described, is that kind of fairly typical?
So. No, New Orleans is definitely an outlier, both with respect to the fact that, as you mentioned in the introduction, they are on a path to becoming the first all-charter district, where the second highest charter market share is in Washington, D.C., which is a bit over 40%. Also, the administration there is facing some challenges, having to think in a novel way about what it means when charter schools are not a supplement to the existing traditional public school system, but when charters become the system and some of the attendant responsibilities associated with that.
So your organization studies educational outcomes, as we mentioned. How well do charter school students perform compared to traditional public school students? And how is that reflected in New Orleans?
CREDO has examined the performance of the large majority of the charter sectors in the country. We find nationally a very mixed bag. So We released a national report last year where we found that although charters have improved since the first time we took a national snapshot in 2009, across the country, about 25% of charter schools provide a significantly higher level of academic performance than their local traditional public school alternatives, and another 25% perform significantly worse, with the rest in the middle. However, New Orleans, like many urban districts, is a bit of an outlier there. We find in New Orleans that about half the schools, charters, provide significantly greater performance than those students would have otherwise received in a traditional public school, and only a handful perform worse. So from a national perspective, New Orleans charter sector is definitely one of the standouts with respect to their quality.
Jessica, is that a view that's widely shared? I mean, is that kind of the word on the street? You know, often sometimes there are impressions that may or may not be matched by the data, right? So yeah. Is that what do people feel about the schools there?
Well, the general perception is that the schools are improving under the Recovery School District. They're not as high performing as the schools under the local school board, which makes sense since the Recovery School District took the schools from the bottom and are bringing them to a new level. But, you know, since 2008, the RSD's district performance score has jumped, you know, by about 50 percentage points. The school district is doing well. You know, whether that is some folks may have larger sort of ideological debates about charter versus traditional and whether we should even though they're doing well, you know, we should still push for a more traditional district. You know, some folks still believe that, but the data definitely does support the idea that they are doing a better job.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about New Orleans creating the nation's first all-charter school system. Our guests are Jessica Williams, education reporter for The Lens in New Orleans. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, Edward Cremata of the Center for Research on Education Outcomes, or CREDO, which is at Stanford University. So, Jessica, though, one of the criticisms that you hear of charters in lots of places around the country is that that's part of the way that they achieve those outcomes is by cherry-picking. Either they create mechanisms to be sure that only the most likely to succeed are actually admitted, or they have open enrollment, or they have kind of an open admissions process, but find a way to get out the kids who are more disruptive or less likely to succeed. Have those criticisms been heard in New Orleans, and is there any evidence to back any of them up?
So. Most definitely, I hear, you know, stories from parents who say that, you know, their kid has some sort of disability. And, you know, when they're on the phone with the charter school leader, they're really excited about getting them to come to the school. And then when they show up, they get the word, oh, well, we really don't have the services to support you. Or if a child has bad behavior at school, they'll quietly sort of pull the parent to the side and say, well, maybe the school down the street is a better option. I have heard those stories. There have also been some criticism of the city's common application.
You're saying that they've been heard anecdotally, but is there any kind of, I'm not diminishing people's concerns, but is there any evidence to back up the fact that these are policies that are actually implemented, whether they're overt or covert?
Not that there are policies, no. But the only policy that I can think of that was most recently criticized was the city's common enrollment process, there are several charter schools that are high performing that are not members of that enrollment process. And the complainants in a civil rights complaint that was filed some time ago alleged that because those schools are not enrolled and because you have to jump through certain hoops to get in, then it does discriminate against students and families who are less, you know, from a lower socioeconomic background or who don't have the time to go out to the school and sit in on the curriculum meeting that's mandatory if you want to get in. That's one policy that you can kind of see that plays out on the ground that can feed or provide some proof to some of those claims.
Mr. Cremata, what about that kind of nationally and in New Orleans, if you'd bring your experience of New Orleans to bear here? Nationally, do charter schools tend to have this aura of kind of ways to implement kind of exclusivity as a way to kind of boost their numbers? And do you think that those are fair criticisms, particularly as it attaches to New Orleans?
I am sure that with, you know, more than 6,000 charter schools in the country, that's legitimate criticism of the behaviors of some of them, specifically in New Orleans. Similarly, when CREDO has visited New Orleans, spoken to folks on the ground there, we've also heard some anecdotal stories that she was talking about. One of the interesting challenges and opportunities potentially in New Orleans is that as they become the system, there is essentially no dodging of any particular type of student of the charter system writ large. And so you're beginning to see see the formation of some institutional and systemic responses, the creation, for example, of a special education consortium to ensure that you utilize the economies of scale that you might get in a traditional district to try to best serve the needs of particular students. Jessica also mentioned the universal enrollment system called OneApp that is sometimes used as a tool to ensure and to try to reduce the, let's say, opportunity for any particular charter to engage in recruitment or retainment practices, discipline policies that might actually be used to invite a certain type of student to leave. And the Recovery School District has also implemented suspension and expulsion kind of policies and guidelines to try to minimize the likelihood of those sorts of things happening.
Give me a final thought, if you would, about how do you think the New Orleans experience is influencing the rest of the country?
Well, the New Orleans experience was largely made possible by the fact that Hurricane Katrina essentially wiped away the existing traditional public school system. It's very unlikely to see this sort of dramatic change happen. However, there are a lot of places that are looking at this, what might be considered a charter restart model. At the heart of what they're doing in New Orleans is the idea that the state is empowered to identify and close the lowest performing traditional public schools and match them with presumably high quality charter operators. And that is gaining traction around the country. It has had a substantial amount of success, as both I and Jessica talked about, up to this point. But if you talk to folks in the leadership roles at the department and Recovery School District, the way that they'll phrase it is, you know, they are on a path and well on a path of taking their schools from an F to a C. The interesting challenge going forward is how you get from a C to an A.
Jessica, what about that?
No, I totally agree. I think that's what I'm seeing here as well. You know, every story that we write, it gets reblogged by so many different folks, particularly when it's about a charter school or a charter school system, or the charter school system is doing something new and different. All eyes are definitely on New Orleans. And, you know, it has been that way for some time. I think the charter school leaders that I've talked to, they feel an tremendous pressure as a result of that to make sure that they are doing everything right, to make sure that they're dotting all their I's, crossing all their T's, because they know that people are watching them. People are waiting to see if this is going to succeed or fail. And so far we've had, you know, inklings of success, and the challenge moving forward is to bring it to that next level.
Jessica Williams is education reporter for The Lens in New Orleans. She was kind enough to join us from member station WWNO. Edward Cremata is senior research analyst for the Center for Research on Education Outcomes, which is based at Stanford University. He was kind enough to join us from a studio there. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you
for having us.
Just ahead, there are a lot of things in the world that might keep you up at night, your job, your health, your bills. But columnist Stephen Petro has one bit of advice.
Wait to worry. You can't worry about the things that you don't know.
He shares some of what he learned dealing with big issues like cancer. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
This week on This American Life.
It seemed as if this time capsule hadn't been opened in 50 years.
Three boys break into an old abandoned house.
All their personal belongings were right there, so they felt so close.
You don't leave things like a wallet with money in it or your address book.
Something terrible had happened. Something catastrophic had happened to the people in the house.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items that are recyclable or made from recycled materials, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. More information can be found at trophytime.com. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly conversation about personal finance, one of our Money Coach conversations. We've been hearing that the economy is slowly but surely picking up, which means that finally people are getting hired again. But in some industries, people are still getting laid off. And unfortunately, we know a little bit about that ourselves. So we thought it might be time to hear the basics of how to handle a layoff. In other words, layoff 101. And if you've ever been laid off, then you know you have all kinds of concerns, financial ones, of course, but research shows that the experience can also take a toll on mental and physical well-being. But studies show there is hope if you have the right attitude. Here to tell us more is Sandra Sutcher. She is professor of management practice at the Harvard Business School, and she's been studying the effects of layoffs, and she's with us now from Boston. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me, Michelle.
You know, now we often hear about like specific life events being particularly stressful, right? Like moving or things of that sort, that, you know, the death of a parent. Among life events, how stressful is layoff? How impactful can it be on a person's life?
Researchers have been looking at the effects of layoffs on individuals for more than 20 years. So we've got lots of data that tells us what this is like for individuals who go through it. And just from a mental health standpoint, there was an analysis of over 100 public health studies between 1990 and 2009. And what they found is that employees have double the risk of developing depression. They have a quadruple risk of an increase in alcoholism. They have an increased risk in committing violent acts, including acts against members of their own family. And they also have a risk of committing suicide. So, you know, this is a very, very difficult experience to overcome, and it's a very hard thing to live through.
There's, of course, the immediate impact, but those effects on your psyche can last for a very long time. In fact, you worked with your colleagues and some students at the school, at the Harvard Business School, on a project in which you interviewed a lot of people affected by layoffs. I just want to play a clip that you provided for us of a man named Bill Sankey. He's an IT professional who's been laid off several times over the course of his career, and this is what he had to say.
The residual effect that I've got from my past is that every day I go to work.
Morning.
And on my way to work, I start thinking, you know, this could easily be my last day.
Wow, that has to take a toll.
Yeah.
That has to take a toll on a person. Wheel around and tell us, what are some of the things that help people recover from this experience or cope with this experience? Have you found some threads?
Actually, the research would suggest that your attitude matters the most. That's sort of a hard message to deliver when we've just read all these statistics. But, you know, employees who've been laid off were tested for how emotional they were at the time of the layoff, over time, and who they blamed for the layoff. And what the researchers found was that the laid-off employees who had the strongest negative emotional reactions to being laid off, or who blamed themselves severely for the layoff, had a harder time recovering. And they would tend to seek out stress-relieving activities like seeking emotional support from family and friends rather than engaging in problem-solving activities like finding a new job. The researchers found that employees with a more optimistic outlook were also more likely to engage in behaviors that led to being reemployed. So your attitude matters a lot. And I guess the message I would give in terms of a tip is don't blame yourself or doubt your own abilities. What distinguishes a layoff from being fired for poor performance is that companies use layoffs because of conditions inside the company itself. So they may have a need to cut costs due to a fall off in demand, as we saw in the Great Recession we just lived through. They may need to increase efficiency and substitute some capital equipment for labor. They may need to restructure to divest themselves of businesses that they're no longer going to be able to be successful in. These are things that sit within the company itself. It doesn't have to do with the quality of performance of the people who were doing the jobs in those areas. Really, it's all about them, and it's not about you.
One of the other things, I think the intriguing findings that a number of people have discovered in recent years is this, unfortunately, this kind of these difficult economic conditions have persisted in this country, is that the longer people are unemployed after a layoff, the harder it is to find work. Why might that be? Are employers holding people's status against them for having been unemployed for a while? What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, it really is true, Michelle, that there is quite a lot of evidence of stigma associated with being laid off, despite how unbelievably persistent and numerous layoffs have become. And in fact, in January of 2014, President Obama got together with the heads of some of the largest U.S. Companies to persuade them to sign on to new business practices that would stop discriminating against the long-term unemployed. The theory, if there is one on the part of the company, is that your skills have grown rusty. If you had actually tried harder, you would have a job by now. And these things just aren't necessarily true of any individual.
Speaking of, attitude on the other side of it, I wonder whether people who've been laid off for a while are selling themselves short. I just want to play another clip from one of the interviews that you provided to us. This is Kelly White, who was laid off from a job in printing. Let's listen.
Until the day I die, a broom will fit my hands. Can I sweep a floor? Yes, I can. Will I? I sure will. If I have to make ends meet, I'll do it. Do I want to do more than that? Yes, I do. Not out of pride, but out of a sense of proper stewardship for my skills and abilities.
What are you hearing in this clip?
When Kelly White talks about a proper stewardship of her skills and abilities, what she's saying is that she wants a job that is equal to as good and effective a worker as she is. In our interview with her, she was marvelous. She talked about liking to do things. Manual dexterity was something that pleased her greatly. And when she was done with the printing work that she did, she loved looking at the layup that she had created. And she said she got huge satisfaction from her ability to do a job well. So I think that Kelly's the kind of person who has a very strong sense of who she is, what she's good at, and she wants to keep that.
So what's the takeaway here? Obviously, this is a very rich subject, and we've just kind of scratched the surface here. So what's the takeaway here is, first of all, take it seriously that being laid off is a profound event and that it does hurt. But then what? Go and what?
So one of the things that really is the best way to treat a layoff is to frame it from a problem to an opportunity. And what I mean by that is to really try to think very hard about the kinds of things that you like to do, to explore alternative career paths. What are you really passionate about? And what are you good at? So there's one terrific exercise I was once asked to do by a career coach who said that I should interview four people who knew me well and have them only talk about my strengths. I had a better sense of who I was, what I was good at, what was important to me than I would have had if I had just thought about these things by myself. We interviewed a guy who had been an aerospace executive, and after reflection and thinking about his life and talking to people, he decided to become a pastor. Now, you know, this kind of story doesn't happen for everyone, but that attitude of proper stewardship of your skills and abilities, keeping faith in yourself, and being willing to really explore what it is that you might want to be doing with your life, I think that that's one way in which this terrible event to an individual can turn into something that might have some positive outcomes for you in the future.
Sandra Sutcher is professor of management practice at the Harvard Business School. She's been researching the effects of layoffs on workers around the country, and she was kind enough to join us from Boston. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
As we've just heard, being fired or losing your job is something that a lot of people have had to worry about in recent years. But our next guest has some advice for those of us who tend to worry a lot about life's what ifs. That advice is to wait. Columnist Stephen Petro recently wrote about his epiphany and learning how to wait to worry for the Washington Post. In the piece, he talked about how he decided to stop worrying about stuff that hadn't even happened yet. And Stephen Petro is with us now. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Michelle, it's great to be with you again.
How did you start thinking about this?
Well, you know, it was a long time ago, and I want to say right at the outset, this wasn't an easy thing for me to learn how to wait to worry. I think I was born with the neurotic anxiety gene, and it had plagued me a long time. But Where it first started was when I saw my grandmother, who was then in her mid-80s, living in a second-floor walk-up in Queens, New York. And my father just became obsessed with the idea that she would become a prisoner in this apartment at some point when something happened to her. And I kept saying to Dad, well, we don't know what's going to happen. So many other things could happen other than her becoming, you know, handicapped and not being able to go up those steps. And the way it played out was she had a different disease. She was hospitalized for the last year of her life, and she got to come home one more time before she died, and she died in her bed. And there I really learned that there would have been no point in worrying the way that my dad did, because you can't predict what is going to happen in life.
Hmm. Did he worry about a lot of things, or was this just one of the things that he was stuck on, or was he stuck on this particular worry?
It was one of those openings for me, you know, how with your parents, you sort of get to know them as you become an adult. So I think that he was a worrier all along, but it really kind of crystallized it for me at that point. And I've seen it since then, especially as he and my mom have gotten older and we've had this conversation, and we've had the wait to worry conversation, which sometimes he and others think wrongfully means, you know, put your head in the sand, don't make a plan. And that is really not what I did, nor what I mean. I think you do have to, you know, be aware of what's happening, understand that life can be unpredictable. You know, I have been laid off in my life several times, and so I keep, you know, my bank account, you know, with a minimum amount of cash in case that happens again. You know, I'm not overly worried about it, but I do have a plan in that way. And so I've taken this philosophy a little bit from the health situation to other parts of my life, and talk about it that way to others as well.
So stop it. Stop for a second there and tell us about the health situation. You were saying in the column, in fact, people who follow your work know that you've written about this before, that you were dealt a blow that a lot of people have had, that you've had to deal with cancer, and that you kind of came to this realization about waiting to worry while you were being treated. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer at the age of 26, and this was 30 years ago this spring. So in part, this essay is kind of born of looking back over those decades and saying to myself, what did I learn? Hopefully, did I learn something? And I do love this quote from the Narnia Chronicles, which says, you must go a little way from here and then turn around and look back. You know, then at last, the true landscape will become visible. And so I think it's only looking back now that I'm able to really see properly. But I got to the two-year mark where I was then supposedly actually cured. And then I started worrying massively, would I relapse? And turned to some of the standbys that I had, that I knew as a young man, which were drinking and drugs and prescription drugs. And they didn't really work for me. And I had a very good friend of the family who had been through something similar, had been diagnosed with cancer. And she just said it to me for the first time when I was whining and complaining and being self-involved. She said, Stephen, wait to worry. You can't worry about the things that you don't know. Worry about what's on your plate today, but enjoy this life. You've got a great new second chapter. And Marion was right.
How do you wait to worry? How do you implement that, especially if you're a worrier?
So, and I'm going to speak from my own experience, which echoes some others, but you know, drugs and alcohol are probably not great tools, and I'm not advocating them.
Okay, write that down. Lose the drugs and alcohol, or at least let that not be the default.
But one of the things that Marion suggested to me, and this, mind you, was in 1984, and that was visualization, guided imagery, which is a process of teaching your mind, your brain, to control the rest of you. And I would lie on my back and I would start this kind of mantra that was really about slowing down the breath and some sort of self-mastery of like the control system, the physiological stuff. And by learning how to do that, I was able to feel more in control. And therefore, part of that control for me was saying, I'm not going to worry. I'm not going to let that overtake me in the same way. That shallow breathing, you know, is not going to choke and consume me.
You remind me of an old editor of mine who would say when we had a big news story that was consuming a lot of our attention and people were kind of reporting back in with their various pieces of the story, and people started getting a little agitated, he'd say, well, don't panic. It's too late to panic.
Panic earlier, right?
That's right. Panic earlier. Get it out the way. So, Stephen, for people who want to start your kind of wait to worry mantra and start by making it their mantra, how do you get started? What's the first thing you should do today? If you say, you know what, today's going to be the day I'm going to implement this. What should I do first?
Yeah. I think that's a really great question, Michelle. And the first thing I would suggest is look at what you're worrying about. Try to understand what's probable and what's possible or what's not even likely. And, you know, if there's some probability that something's going to happen, let's say that you feel that you're going to lose your job, well, worrying is fine and also is, you know, preparing your resume and getting hooked up on LinkedIn and doing those things. But if you put other elements in the not likely to happen, just try to take them off your plate and fill that space in your mind and your heart with, you know, with the positive things. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, some California guru, because here I am in North Carolina, I'm not a California guru, but I think that we can make these conscious decisions and try to put things to the side so that we really can live full lives in our present state.
Stephen Petro is an etiquette columnist. His latest piece for The Washington Post is titled, "He Found the Best Anti-Anxiety Drug Was Guided Imagery and Learning to Wait to Worry." And we caught up with him at member station WUNC, which is in Durham, North Carolina. Stephen Petro, thanks for speaking with us once again.
Michelle, thank you so much.
Up next, getting your child to read in the summer can sometimes be a drag, but our group of diverse writers and parents say it's more than just slogging through a list of required reading.
It's important for all children, white children, African American, Asian, and all of the mixed children that are out there to see what other kids look like in their experiences.
We've got some great summer book choices, and today we focus on books with Latino characters. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from John and Catherine Debs in support of NPR's new global headquarters and production center in Washington, D.C. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
On the next Community Cinema, the documentary film The New Black takes viewers into the pews and onto the streets as it tells the story of the historic fight to win marriage equality in Maryland and charts the evolution of this divisive issue within the black community. I'm Sean Powers with Illinois Public Media News. Join me for the free public screening and panel discussion at the Spurlock Museum on Tuesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. Free garage and street parking is available.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana with instruction in Iyengar Yoga and special classes for men, women, 50-plus, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start the first week of June. Details at yoga-cu.com or 344-YOGA.
Coming to WILL-TV, from the late 1940s until the early 1970s, millions of viewers of all ages saw great musical acts each Sunday night on The Ed Sullivan Show. The latest installment from the My Music series brings you full-length musical performances spanning from 1963 to 1968, including The Beatles, The Doors, The Rolling Stones, and more. Watch Ed Sullivan's Rock and Roll Classics, Friday night at 8 on WILL-TV.
All I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, we want to get some advice about summer reading. If you have small people or teenagers in your house, and you are probably already in the throes of summeritis, and yes, I think I just made that word up, it means that the kids are ready for the reading, writing, and arithmetic to end. But the research is very clear that summer reading is crucial if kids are going to come back to school ready to learn, and that can be especially important for kids of color. But it can also be more challenging for kids of color because they don't see themselves in many children's books. We wanted to talk more about this, and we are going to pay particular attention today to books for and about Latino children who represent a growing share of America's elementary school population. With us now, Viviana Hurtado, founder of Latinas for Latino Lit. That's an organization that supports Latino authors and encourages literacy. You know her as the blogger-in-chief at the Wise Latino Club, but she also wants to make sure that you know that she is the tia loca to three of her nieces, nephews.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Felix Contreras is co-host of NPR's Alt Latino podcast. He's the father of two boys. He's here with us as well. Graciela Tiscareño Sato is author of the bilingual children's book, Good Night, Captain Mama. She's also a former Air Force pilot and a mom of three, so don't call her if your self-esteem is feeling challenged. And Carmen Agra Didi has written numerous children's books, including the 2008 Pura Belpre Honor Award-winning Martina the Beautiful Cockroach. She's a mom and a grandmother. Welcome to everybody. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So, Viviana, you know, we noticed that a recent University of Wisconsin study revealed that fewer than 8% of children's books in 2013 were written by or about people of color, which I think is a little surprising, given that a growing percentage of America's school children are children of color. I wanted to ask why you think that matters. And I also want to mention, if you're feeling self-esteem challenged, others don't listen to this, that in addition to her other accomplishments, Viviana also has a doctorate. Why do you think that matters?
Well, it matters because we know what the pedagogical power of identification is. And so if you start to see all of a sudden yourself represented in books around you, in characters, not just the characters, but think about the situations, the locations. La Bodega, for example, in Latino culture is a really strong, the little store on the corner, that can go so far in just building confidence, opening up imagination and curiosity to continue reading. So one of the things that Latinas for Latino Lit, L4LL, is really passionate about is really promoting this incredible talent of U.S. Latino authors and illustrators who, by the way, have been writing for at least 25 to 30 years. Yeah. Because what that's going to do, they'll be reading, for example, Graciela Tiscareño Sato today or Duncan Tonatui today, and tomorrow, the Iliad. Oh. It's a gateway to learning, imagination, and educational achievement and success.
Felix, I'd like to ask you, though, particularly as a dad of two boys, do you think it matters? Did you ever, when you were growing up, see a kid's book with somebody like you in it?
I didn't read anything with someone like me until I got to college and took a Chicano Lit course. I mean, that's, you know, grammar school, middle school, junior high school, and then high school. So, yeah, it does matter. It does matter, especially in today's environment, where there are a lot of multicultural families, a lot of multicultural environments in the schools where we are here in Montgomery County and the Washington, D.C. area and all around the country. So it does make a difference. And
have you noticed with your boys, does their interest pick up, you think, if they are exposed to stories that have some connection to them on that level?
My kids will tell you that I have too many stories. So I'm always talking about when I grew up or, you know, something that my dad told me, you know, when he was growing up, or my mother and father, you know, and they are curious to find stories that fit into that narrative, I think. You know, when we talk about, like, my father growing up as a migrant farm worker, you know, they're interested in finding stories about that lifestyle, you know, or growing up in an inner city in Sacramento in California, you know, dealing with some of the things I dealt with as a young kid. They're interested in finding stuff like that, I think.
Graciela, what about you? Tell us about, first of all, your experience of this, and what are your thoughts about keeping kids interested in reading, and why you think it matters to have, you know, characters with different backgrounds represented in children's books?
Yeah, well, you know, I also didn't have a chance to read books that had characters that were anything like me when I was growing up. I'm the oldest of five children born to Mexican immigrants. So I don't remember any children's books like that that were part of my childhood. I remember reading, you know, biographies that my mom had on Jackie Kennedy Onassis. My mom liked to read different things, but just really, as far as children's literature, I just didn't have it until much later. But I do have three kids now, and what I wanted to say is I've taken a slightly different approach to creating literature. And while, you know, we have the Cesar Chavez books, and we have the, you know, Grandma's Chocolate, and then we have a lot of the heritage books that are important to me just culturally, I have bilingual and biracial kids. Mm-hmm. So I want to produce literature that's forward-looking and aspirational, which is why I told my military story in a bilingual children's book, because while kids are reading in the summer and all year, I want them to be looking forward to who they can become. Mm-hmm. I want the children's literature to inspire, you know, future professions, future careers that they have not been able to see themselves with, which is why we see, you know, a Latina aviator in a military flight suit on the cover of the children's book that I wrote. And so that's how I approach it. And so our house is filled with books about, you know, the Latino culture, the Japanese culture, which is my husband's culture. We have Zimbabwean pictures. We have Little House on the Prairie. And we have, you know, what does it mean to be global? So I want my kids to be global citizens, you know, big thinkers, and then see examples and role models from all kinds of cultures, all races, because that reflects who my kids are, since they are not just of one culture, but several. So that's the approach that I've taken. And I always mix nonfiction and fiction. That's a big, big, big part.
Okay, well, hold that thought for a minute, because I want to hear more about some of these kind of practical tips for getting kids excited and continuing their interest, you know, over the summer. So hold that thought. I want to hear more about that. Carmen, okay, Didi, what about you? You are kind of our, if anybody's read a book by a Latino author, it might have been you, because you've been writing them for two decades, and also with a very kind of diverse selection of topics and themes, and talk about that. You visit a lot of schools trying to motivate kids to read. What are some of the things that you've observed over the time?
Well, I grew up, yes, I'm the ancient lady on this panel.
No, you're just the most experienced diva, that's all.
No.
Not old, our senior diva.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what a lovely title. Mm-hmm. I want a crown. I grew up in the South in the 60s, so, you know, and I almost wanted to say hola, y'all, as my way of introduction. What I was introduced, of course, to what we are in common parlance is now called the Dick and Jane readers. And I remember looking at them, and it was always Dick Run, See Jane Run, you know. And I remember, who is chasing all these peoples? And this poor woman, this poor first grade teacher, maybe going, nobody chasing them, honey. And I say, where are the brown peoples? Well, baby, that's another book. Where is it? You're going to have to write it, honey. And so, you know, it was such a different experience. Though I will tell you, I wrote in Spanish at home. I read in English in school. It was a different time. We didn't have this, you know, this plethora of material. And yes, we say, yes, it's only a small percentage, but it's there. Children do have access now to wonderful books. You know, authors like Alma Florada and, you know, Lucia Gonzalez, and we have the Bossy Gallito, and we have, you know, My Name is Maria Isabel. But my favorite book as a child, and I think it's telling, the one that turned me on to reading had nothing to do with my, the topography of my life. You know, who would live next door? Who did I play with? It was Charlotte's Web. It was Charlotte's Web because I loved animals. And I think the thing that catalyst that really can just really start things moving in a child, especially a reluctant reader, as we call them, is finding what they love. What do they love? I mean, if it's a heritage issue, great, that's great. But if it's what they love is, you know, outer space, iguanas, I think that it's really critical to connect the child with the book that ignites their mind, you know, really.
If you're just joining us, we're having our regular parenting roundtable today. We're focusing on summer reading. We have a particular interest in books for and about Latino kids. But as Carmen Agroditi just told us, we're interested in exciting books in general. Our guests are the veteran award-winning children's book writer Carmen Agroditi, author and military veteran Graciela Tiscarino Sato, Felix Contreras, it's NPR's Alt Latino podcast, and Viviana Hurtado, co-founder of Latinas for Latino Lit. Somebody wanted to jump in. Vivian, I think you wanted to jump in on that point. So Carmen's gotten us started off by saying the main thing to start and can make that connection is what's the child interested in. So to sort of take us on from there, what are some of the other great books that you are recommending for this summer?
Wow. Well, we have L4LL. We have a summer reading program that launched actually on Sunday. It's a 10-week program that you can access online through mid-August. And we have reading lists, and Graciela and Carmen are on those reading lists of our recommended reading list, 100% curated with U.S. Latino authors and illustrators. And what's terrific about this, for example, in the 4 to 8-year-olds, which is where Graciela's book is clustered, and they're going to be focusing on stories, you know, storytelling, the way Graciela was able to do that, and that's going to be furthering reading comprehension, reading and writing skills. But in addition to Graciela's book, I'm really crazy about anything that Monica Brown writes. Mm-hmm. We have side by side the story of Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez, a heritage book, as was mentioned a little bit earlier. They're beautifully illustrated. And Monica Brown, by the way, and I think this is really important to note, the talent of these authors and these illustrators that have, again, been writing for at least 2, if not 3 decades. There's a literary canon from at least 2 to 3 decades ago. These are nationally recognized authors. Monica Brown was part of the National Book Festival. So they're writing amazing, imaginative, curiosity-piquing work that is also building all kinds of important reading and writing skills, but they're also telling a story for really anybody to enjoy.
Okay, what about that? So Vivian's got a particular approach here, which is to say it's a 10-week kind of program. I think the idea is to kind of stay on track, maybe one book a week, maybe write a paragraph about it. A lot of jurisdictions are doing that, and public libraries are doing that, and they say if you turn in your paper with your paragraph for each book, then you get like tickets for a pizza or something like that. Felix, does that work with your boys?
I think it will this summer.
I think they're going to need more than a pizza.
Maybe a Google Chromebook, which is what we're giving away as a reading incentive at the end of
our
program.
Oh, is that right? A Google Chromebook at the end of it. So, Felix, what do you find that works? Is it...
You know, for example, we have my youngest is, I'm not trying to out him because he just said his class, his 10-year-old classmates listens to Tell Me More.
Okay.
So, but he was, I think we consider him a reluctant reader, you know, trying to get him to read stuff and do less gaming, that kind of stuff. And what works for him, one of the things we tried was buying him a Kindle. Since he's already adapted to the technology and the screen and technology, we try to incorporate that into his reading. And he's and I told him, I can, you know, you can buy whatever book you want, you know, within reason, in order to accommodate that. And it did pick up a little bit his reading activity.
How do you make sure that he's actually reading and not gaming? He's not slipping some Minecraft in there. Not that we're against Minecraft,
Kindle.
But how do you?
That's Kindle.
Yeah. By the Kindle and not the iPad Mini. It's only for...
The Kindle's for reading. And just, you know, looking over his shoulder, the old, you know, old school, just kind of checking up on him, sneaking up on him when he doesn't think I'm around, that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, like I said, he's a reluctant reader, but, you know, he just went out and bought a whole series of books that he wants to read. He's going to read that over the summer. I'd really like to get him involved in this 10-week program, as well as my 13-year-old.
Do you make them write something, too, to be sure that they've actually read it, or do you just kind of let it go
free? They do that during the school year. Summer,
you feel, should be different.
Summer, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, this
well, Graciela, were you going to jump in here?
Writing?
Okay.
I'd like to add something about the writing.
Yes, please.
So... I want to just explain the ages that I have in my home. So I have a son who's 7, and I have a daughter who just turned 10, and then a daughter who's blind who's 12. So these are 3 very different characters, very different kids. And so what I do is I ask them, okay, you know, we're going to be reading a lot this summer, and we're going to read some lists and stuff, but tell me what you really want to know more about this summer. I just had this conversation with them. My son said, I want to know more about water insects. One thing. Okay, so we're going to go find some nonfiction books on water insects. My daughter's into hummingbirds, all birds. She wants to be a future bird scientist. And my 12-year-old's into languages. So we're doing Braille plus Spanish and English books. Okay, so very different types of interests. But what I just thought was very important is, you know, how do they like to read? You know, we've got paper readers. We've got Kindle readers. We've got, you know, tablets. Let's honor that. Let's give them those options because whatever it takes to get them to read, right? But then I don't want to make them do book reports in the summer, just my own choice. I mean, you know, they'll write a couple of sentences. I have my kids journal in the summer about what we're doing, just 3 sentences or
That's
longer
nice.
If they're older. So they can read separately from the writing so it doesn't feel so schooly for them, you know, but yet they're still writing about the things that we just do naturally in the summer.
Oh,
so we
idea.
Get both done.
Get both done.
But we're starting again with their interests and their experiences. So it doesn't feel like a chore to them. It's just something that we do. And again, that mix of fiction and nonfiction reading, I think, is also very important.
Okay, Carmen,
add that as well.
Carmen, we have time for a final word from you. And I do want to mention that we are interested in readers and listeners and your suggestions. So reach out on Twitter. Tweet us at Tell Me More NPR and share your summer reading picks. And those will be available for everybody to share. So, Carmen, final thought from you.
You know what? I just want to plug some great books I love.
Let's hear it.
All right. So for picture books, and by the way, picture books are critical for younger children, for K-5. Mm-hmm. For many children, this is their first introduction to fine art. Not everyone considers illustration fine art. I do. I've met too many incredible illustrators. Mm-hmm. Gary Soto, Too Many Tamales. Oh, my God. Christmas story about Maria who borrows her mom's ring and loses it in the masa, the dough. And then they've got to eat the tamales to find it. It's fantastic.
From Fresno, California.
I know. I love that. Yeah. Pam Munoz Ryan. She has, this is a more of a middle grade reader, Esperanza Rising. Of course, Esperanza means hope. So it's a play on words, hope rising. And it's a well-to-do Mexican girl who, through the vagaries of life and various family tragedies, okay. ends up as an itinerant worker. And then Subversive. I love Subversive.
Okay,
books.
That sounds good. I think that's
every book doesn't have to have the Latina itinerant worker or the Cuban refugee. I'm from Cuba or okay. whatever, for heaven's sakes.
Okay.
Lyle Crocodile People by Bernard Weber, an oldie but a goodie.
All right.
It's about a crocodile who moves into a neighborhood and the neighbors just aren't.
All right. Well, that sounds great. And we got a bunch there. We'll put them all on Twitter for you. So we heard from Atlanta, Carmen Agraditi. She wrote The Cheshire Cheese Cat, A Dickens of a Tale. Too bad she didn't mention that one. Graciela Tiscarino Sato is with us. She's the author of Goodnight, Captain Mama. She joined us from her home in Hayward, California. Felix Contreras, co-host of NPR's Alt Latino podcast, was here. Viviana Hurtado, co-founder of Latinas for Latino Lit, was here. They were here with us in Washington, D.C. So thank you. And before we go, I have to take a moment to remember a woman who helped make reading and learning fun for millions of kids in this country, the actress Lee Chamberlain. You might remember seeing her singing and dancing on the groundbreaking children's television show The Electric Company. She entertained and educated young people along with a couple of other people who wound up doing a thing or two in the arts, Rita Moreno and Morgan Freeman. She never stopped working to spread the power of words. At the end of her life, she lived in Paris, helping African-American playwrights develop their productions for the stage. She passed away last week at the age of 76 while visiting her son in North Carolina. We just wanted to remember Lee Chamberlain. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. Mm-hmm.